Hey Church, glad you could join us this Sunday here at Revels Local Alliance Church. We are continuing on with our series called Encounters with Jesus. This is the third part. The first part we talked about when Jesus interacted with Nicodemus, who was a Pharisee and a member of the Sanhedrin, and Jesus told him that he had to be born again. And then the second week we talked about how Jesus interacted with a Samaritan woman at the well who was rejected and on the outside of society, and how Jesus was very gentle and kind and told her about who he is as the Messiah. So each week what we're doing is we're looking at an encounter in the Gospel of John that Jesus had with a different person or group of people. And we're looking at what we can learn about Jesus and who he is and what he's like, and also maybe a bit about ourselves by seeing what the humans were like when they encountered Jesus and what issues and joys and struggles that they had, which we may find for ourselves as well. All right, so today we're continuing on in John chapter 4, and it sort of continues on right from last week's sermon. So verse 43, so the setup is that Jesus is walking from Jerusalem in the south up to Galilee in the north, and he bypassed through Samaria where he met the woman in the well, and this is continuing on from there. John chapter 4 verse 43. After the 2 days, that's 2 days in Samaria, he departed for Galilee. For Jesus himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in his own hometown. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him, having seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the feast, for they too had gone to the feast. All right, that is kind of a weird couple of verses. So let's look at what it says here. It says, now Jesus, it says, for Jesus himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in his hometown. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. So there seems to be some kind of juxtaposition, something deeper for us to kind of pursue in this interesting dynamic in these verses. No honor in his hometown, and yet they welcomed him. Now, the word honor means in the Greek to value correctly, or it also has connotations to see or perceive the true value of someone or something. That's how you honor something. You value it correctly, appropriately. You see or perceive the true value. And so what Jesus was saying, he said that a prophet has no honor. He is his value and his who he is isn't seen or counted worthy in his own hometown. Now, I learned quite a bit personally about correctly honoring people when I used to work long time ago in the British consulate in a foreign country. At that time, I worked there for a couple of years. I met many dignitaries. I met ambassadors and politicians, consul generals, all kinds of people that were to be honored, people who represented their various countries in official capacities, people who had been knighted by the Queen, so sirs and sir such and such and sir such and such. And we were all taught when I was working there about how the different protocols are when meeting different dignitaries, how to give honor to these various people who were representing different things. Now, if it's important that we give honor to people in certain circumstances, imagine the honor and respect that we should be giving to Jesus. And Jesus is God the Son. He is the Savior. He is the creator of the universe. So you can imagine the honor that he is due if we can correctly value and rightly perceive who he was. But the Bible says quite repeatedly that humans, for the most part, missed entirely who Jesus was, and that they did not give him the honor that he deserved. And this was even prophesied in the Old Testament, way back hundreds of years before Jesus was born. There were prophecies given about his life and what he was going to do and what he was going to be like. One of those prophecies is in Isaiah 53 and verse 5. And it says there, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. As one from whom men hid their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. We didn't assign him the value or perceive who he was. And so we rejected him. The people at the time when Jesus was alive rejected him, hid their faces with him. He was even despised and so on. And so there's this dynamic that we're looking at today. Now, what's really important is two tiny little words in 1 verse 44 and 1 verse 45. I'm reading today from the ESV, the English Standard Version. Now, translating from one language to another is a difficult task. I know I've done some translation work. I speak a couple of languages, and so I understand the challenges in translating. The Bible was written in Greek and then much later translated into English. But when you translate it, there's lots of different approaches to take. There's a word-for-word translation where you're trying to translate the exact wording and keep the wording as intact as possible from one language to the other. It's more precise, but maybe not quite as readable. And then there's the thought-for-thought version of translation where you look at the meaning or the thought of the original text and you translate that into something that is quite readable in English. And so you have different Bibles who have different strengths and weaknesses, different translations into English that have different strengths and weaknesses. And so what I tend to do when I'm preaching a sermon, preparing, is try and read the text in at least three or four different translations in English and try and pick different methods of translation. So I try and pick one or two Bibles that go for the word for word translation technique and maybe one or two Bibles that go for the thought for thought. The reason why I'm mentioning it is because the word for word translations pick up on two very important, very small words in this text that the thought for thought Bibles tend to gloss over. Verse 44, it says, "For Jesus had testified," so he departed Galilee. For Jesus, that means because. So he left Samaria to head to Galilee because he himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in his own hometown. And he's going back to his hometown. So that's interesting. It says that Jesus' trip to Galilee was deliberate, even though he knew that he wasn't going to get any honor. Therefore, Jesus, or for Jesus himself, had testified. So off to Galilee, boys. Didn't you say, Jesus, that you don't get any honor there? Yeah, that's why we're going. That's what it says in the Greek. Therefore. And then verse 45. So, the word so. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. So therefore and so means this is a deliberate thing. Jesus is provoking a deliberate response. He knows the reception that he's going to get. He knows that he's not going to be properly perceived and properly valued in his home area of Galilee. But he goes there in spite of that, because of that, in order to deal with that issue. And so he provokes this thing. It's quite interesting. So if you're reading in the ESV, the for in verse 44 and the so in verse 45 is very important. He went there because he wanted to highlight and confront their lack of honor. And he wanted to show that their motives for their welcome were lacking and inadequate and misguided. So he wasn't fazed by the welcome. He was going for something deeper, a heart issue that lied at a deeper level than the superficial welcome that he had received, because he knew he wasn't being rightly valued. And he did that in order to reveal their heart to themselves, the people's heart to themselves, and expose their need for a Messiah to further reveal who he was. So he went there to hold a mirror up, maybe, to those people, to show them that their purposes and reasons for welcoming him were suspect, and also to reveal who he was. And Jesus, as I said, he didn't avoid this conflict, this difficult situation. He actually headed straight for it. So that is very interesting. Maybe even provoked it, knowing the response that he was going to get. All right, so let's see how this welcoming on one side, this superficial welcoming, but this lack of honor on the other side kind of play themselves up. Verse 46. So he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water into wine. And at Capernaum, there was an official whose son was ill. And when this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. All right, so now we've got a location, Cana. Cana was the site of the first sign or a miracle that John highlights in his gospel of Jesus turning the water into wine. We'll look at that as one of the other encounters with Jesus a little bit further into the series. Last week I mentioned that John gives seven I am statements throughout his gospel so that Jesus is revealing who he is in seven different statements. He also does seven miracles. Now, Jesus did a lot more miracles than seven, but John chooses seven miracles, and each of them, John says, is a sign or a pointer or an indicator to who Jesus is. These seven signs. These are not just seven cool things that Jesus did, but seven miracles that John specifically chooses to write about that highlights, that points to who Jesus is. Now, so we've got Cana, and we've got this, this sign that was done there, and we're about to read about a second sign. And then we've got this man. It says he is an official. That word in Greek is basilikos, which means he is an officer of the king. He's in the king's court. It doesn't say what exactly he does for the king, but he works for the king. Now, the king, there is only one king in Israel at that time, a man by the name of Herod Antipas. He's a bad, bad dude. He's a bad guy. He is the king of the Jews. He works under the Roman government. The Romans keep him around so that he can kind of administer a bunch of the provincial things and the Romans don't have to deal with it. But he's a bad guy. He was the guy who married his brother's wife. And then when John the Baptist rebuked him about it, he had John the Baptist's head cut off. So Herod Antipas, not a good guy. And this is one of his officials, one of the members of court, one of the basilicus. And he lives in Capernaum, and he walks about 25 miles to come to Jesus, because Jesus is at Cana. And he says he came there to ask him to come down, to go from Cana to Capernaum and heal his son, because his son was at the point of death. Now, it's interesting on lots of different levels. This guy would have been very rich. He would have applied and paid for every kind of medical treatment possible at the time. He's obviously exhausted everything that he had, every avenue that he had going for him, and he's at his wit's end. And Jesus comes, and he gets up and he walks down to meet him. So it's a man of faith, a man that is maybe desperate. He would have been in a desperate situation. He needs an answer from God. He needs a miracle, and he comes to Jesus to receive it. And so that's shows some humility for somebody who's in a position of power, or at least somebody who's very connected. So they've got this humble man connected with a corrupt king walking 25 miles to come meet Jesus because his son is dying. Most likely this man would have been Jewish. It doesn't say for sure, but probably he was Jewish. So how did Jesus respond? So that was quite an act of faith by this guy. So how did Jesus respond to this act of faith? Remembering that Jesus is there with a purpose to highlight this honor versus this superficial welcoming disconnect that the people have. Verse 48. So Jesus said to him, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." Now, that's a bit harsh. It kind of cuts across what he's there for, what the man's there for. It's a bit of a slap in the face, a bit of a rebuke, a correction. One thing we do need to take into consideration there is the "you" in that sentence is "you" plural. In English, we don't have a "you" plural. They do in Greek. The best we have in North American English is like a "y'all." So verse 48, Jesus said to him, to the official, to the basilicus, he said to him, but behind him are all these other people gathered at Cana, this sort of crowd of folk. Jesus said to him, unless all of you see signs and wonders, all of you, y'all, will not believe. Now, that's really quite the thing. Now, if we go back a few verses, just scrolling up. There we go, in verse 45, we already read it. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. We read that. Having seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the feast, for they too had gone to the feast. So these Galileans welcomed him because they had seen the miracles that Jesus had done, that he had performed in Jerusalem. And so that's why they had come out. And this man had heard about these miracles. He came down and Jesus replied, unless to him and to the crowd, you all, unless you all see the signs and the wonders, you won't believe. He said, you're here just for the miracles. And because you're here just for the miracles, you're not seeing who I am. You're welcoming me because I can do something for you, but you're misperceiving my value. You're not properly honoring who I am, because I am so much more than a miracle worker. I'm so much more than somebody with a gift of healing. Jesus is saying, unless you see, you won't believe. You're focusing on the wrong thing. You're focusing on the miracle. You should be focusing on me, on who I am, and the miracles will flow from that. Bit of a harsh response, as he said. Now, why was Jesus cautious about this? Why was he kind of using the spiritual scalpel on this man and the people in the crowd in Galilee? Well, earlier, a couple of chapters, when Jesus was in Jerusalem and was performing miracles, this is what it said about it. John 2, verses 23 and 24. Now, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them because he knew all people and needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man. So what happened down in Jerusalem, Jesus had done some miracles, prayed for some folks, some stuff had happened. People were starting to believe because they'd seen the miracles. And Jesus was cautious, though, because he's like, no, I know what humanity's like. They're going to see the power that I have, and they're going to try and use me. Or they're going to see the power that I have, and they're going to try and enthrone me to take out the Romans. He said, I know there's ulterior motives in people's hearts, even surrounding signs and wonders and miracles. And so when this man has asked for this healing and the crowd is gathered, Jesus is like, you people, unless you see the signs and wonders, you won't believe. He said, you're looking at the wrong thing. If you don't see, you won't believe. You really should believe in order to see. So Jesus, very interesting, was cautious about entrusting himself to humanity because he knew their alternative motives and desires. And this was the case here as well. But here we see a really good response. The official, the king's official, isn't put off, isn't discouraged, isn't dissuaded, isn't sidetracked, because he loves his son and he wants to see a miracle, and he knows that Jesus potentially has the power to do this. So verse 49 said, the official said to Jesus, sir, come down before my child dies. In verse 50, Jesus said to him, go. Your son will live. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. Now, that's a change in dynamic right there. Instead of, we've seen the miracles, now we believe, this guy hadn't seen the miracles, and now when he heard Jesus' word, heard Jesus' promise, he believed. He lived out, he obeyed, he moved forward based upon the word that Jesus had given him. And so that's a shift in faith. That's not a, if I see it, I'll believe it. That's more of a, I believe it, therefore I'm going to see it. Verse 51. As he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better. And they said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour, so seventh hour, the first hour in Jewish time clock at the sort of at the time, 6 a.m. was the start of the day. That was hour zero. So the seventh hour would have been 1 p.m. So yesterday at 1 p.m., the fever left him, and the father knew that was the hour when Jesus said to him, "Your son will live." And he himself believed, and all of his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judah to Galilee. Now that's amazing. Now what can we learn? A few things that we can learn out of that. There's a lot to learn. A lot of it we've already kind of unpacked. But one thing that we can say for sure is that Jesus' power is absolute. He didn't have to physically go down. This guy, he didn't know who Jesus was. He didn't know that Jesus was God. He just knew that Jesus had this power. So in his mind, he thought, if I can bring Jesus to my son, he can touch him and lay hands on him, pray for him, and he'll be healed. And Jesus just spoke the word. And 25 miles away, the son was healed at exact moments when he spoke the word. See, Jesus, God, he is all-powerful. And not only all-powerful, but he's omnipresent. God is spirit and he's everywhere. And so Jesus just needs to give the word. And if it was 25 miles away or 25,000 miles away, the kid would have been healed. Jesus is so much more than what the people in Galilee at that time perceived him to be. His power was greater, who he was greater. And so that was the sign that, this is why it's a second sign. The second sign is his power was much more than people had bargained for, and who he was. That points to who he was, not just a man who God answers prayers on, but God himself. So Jesus' power is absolute. Just all you need to do is speak the word and the thing happens. Maybe you're in a situation right now where you need Jesus to speak the word over you and for you to see something happen. Go to Jesus, believe, trust, put your requests before him, and trust that God will answer you. Right, miracles. That's point number two. Miracles are a sign on who he is. Miracles weren't just for the sake of show or because they're cool or because somebody was sick. Jesus performed miraculous things in order to signify, John said, as a sign to who he is. They were a pointer. And so when people pursued the miracles, they were missing the point of the miracles. They should have been pursuing the miracle worker. They should have been pursuing the person, not the miracle itself. So miracles, important. We believe they still happen today. We believe that God still does miracles in our day and age. When we seek him, when we pray for him, God can certainly do those things if that's his will. But they are primarily there for a sign to point to who he is. Another thing, as we kind of talked about a little bit today, is honor. We need to honor Jesus for who he is. That's why he was doing this miracle, to point to himself, to highlight the difference between the honor and the superficial welcome. We need to honor Jesus for who he is, not for what he can do for us. And that's a huge deal. I think that's maybe one of the main points behind the book of Job in the Old Testament. The first few chapters in Job, we read that Job was very rich and blessed and family and cattle and lands and all the things. And then Satan comes before God and says to God, yeah, the reason why Job praises you and loves you is because you bless him. He's only in it for what he can get out of it. So no wonder he follows you, God, because you give him so much. If you would let me, and Satan goes on to say, if you would let me take away his possessions and take away his blessings, you'll see that he will curse you to his face. God said, go ahead. Satan did. Job didn't curse God. And then Satan went back a second time and said, that's because you've given him good health. If you let me attack his body and remove his health, then he will curse you to your face. And God said, go ahead. And Satan attacked Job's body. And Job did not curse God to his face. You see, when Satan made those accusations to God, he was like it was like a double slander. He was saying to God, the only reason people love you is because you give them stuff. You give them blessings, you give them health, you give them stuff. That's the only reason that humans love you. And the only reason that humans want to like respond and worship is because of the stuff you give them. So they're seeing that God isn't lovely and lovable in and of himself, and that humans were just fickle creatures who were in it for what they could get out of it. That was the accusation in the book of Job that Satan made, and then the rest of the book plays out the dynamic of that's not true. It wasn't true about Job, and it wasn't true about God. It's certainly not true about Jesus. And so Jesus interacts with, confronts this subtlety in the human heart about people wanting to use God for their own purposes. And he rebukes that. And he says, instead, I'll do this sign so you can see who I am. Remember he said to the Samaritan woman last week, if you knew who it was who was asking you for a drink, you would ask me and I would give you living water and you'd never be thirsty again. Like, see who I am. See the relationship that I'm offering. And it's far bigger than the powerful things that I can do, the miraculous signs and wonders. So that's not saying the miraculous signs and wonders aren't important or that we shouldn't pray for them. We certainly should, and they are important, but only in the context of who Jesus is, only in the context of worshiping and honoring Jesus for who he is. And then, lastly, a point that we could draw out of that about the prophet having no honor in his own home, you know, in his hometown. Just because we grew up around Jesus, you know, maybe in the church, maybe you know a bunch of verses, a bunch of Sunday school songs, maybe a bunch of worship songs. Just because we grew up around Jesus, we may well still be missing the mark to see and interact with him for who he really is. Familiarity. These guys knew Jesus. Yeah, you know, he's Mary and Joseph's son. There's his brothers. Meh. Jesus, oh, he can do some miracles. Maybe he's plugged in with God. They couldn't see who he really was because they were too familiar. They were too casual. They'd been around too much. They didn't have the scales removed from their eyes. So maybe that's something we need to be careful of being very casual and being very, you know, superficial, blasé about our relationship with Jesus and not honoring him the way that he needs to be, the way that he deserves to be, the way that is beneficial to us because it puts us in right relationship with him. So then when we go and ask for miracles, it's out of a context of honor and worship and not out of a context of, hey, Jesus, can you do a favor for me? Can you help a guy out? I need $100 to go do a thing. No. All right. So this little story, this interesting dynamic, you know, Jesus comes to the town deliberately because he knows that they're not going to honor him, and yet they welcome him, and then the guy comes. This whole interesting dynamic reveals more about who Jesus is and the subtleties of sin in humanity's hearts. It reveals Jesus as being more powerful than the people at that time could possibly expect. And that was only because he is God, and he was showing himself to be God. So pursue Jesus, not the miracles. And if you pursue Jesus, you are placing yourself in a right position in relationship with him, in a place where miracles can more easily flow. So it's a win-win situation. All right, praise the Lord. I hope that was helpful. I hope that was insightful. I look forward to you next week, catching up with you next week, and when we continue on with our series called Encounters with Jesus. Goodbye.